How and when the information is released has everything to do with returning our consciousness to the original timeline. As Preston Nichols said earlier in this book, if enough people are conscious of what is happening, we will graduate to the realm of the Creator. The Whore of Babylon referred to in the Book of Revelation signifies the entire subjugation of the material world to the Kundalini system. In Crowley's tarot, Babylon rides the beast, symbolizing the ruling principle of our universe. Whether we like it or not, we live in a universe of division that is ruled by the bestial urges over which Babylon presides. It is the same story as Eve and the serpent. All of this is compactly symbolized in the sexual impulse which unites man spiritually with the material. Aleister Crowley taught what is known as the left-hand path, which is the unification with the Holy Spirit through sexuality. The right-hand path refers to the unification with the Holy Spirit through purely noble methods, as was expressed in the Grail romances. Esotericists are notorious for warning disciples of the extreme danger associated with the left-hand path. The trouble with the right-hand path is that people pursuing it often fall prey to the elements of desire associated with the left-hand path because they have unhandled issues there or have improperly explored it. Students often pursue the left-hand path for the wrong reasons, most notable of which are sex and power. In all fairness, not too many aspirants make it to the top by either path. This is why the Buddha taught the middle way. There has to be a balance. Earlier in this book, Preston stated quite clearly that releasing the Kundalini was the way to clear out implants. The Babylon working, as performed by members of the Wilson family, was a grand-scale operation designed to clear out the supreme implant of the universe. It was meant to open up the revelation of the truth and bring the entirety of existence into account. The bottleneck of information I referred to above is critical. The more information that comes out and permeates consciousness, the more things will change. The powers behind the Montauk Project have their own agenda, as Preston previously described. They want to maintain their own position of control. As far as my own personal investigation of these matters, an interesting pattern has revealed itself. As soon as I encountered Preston Nichols' story of Montauk, I began to find correspondences with 666. This included my encounters with Cameron, Amado Crowley and various other factors described in the Montauk books. 666 is the enigma of the physical realm, which is probably best illustrated in the structure of the carbon atom. A single carbon atom contains 6 protons, 6 neutrons and 6 electrons. As all organic life is carbon-based, 666 is considered the enigma for life in the flesh. In esoteric terms, this present work is a graduation to the realm of 777, the code for the spiritual system or connection that lies between organic life and pure spirit. Beyond 777, lies the realm of 888. This is the sacred number for the Christ consciousness. It also represents the infinite. It is not really a realm that you sit around and study, because once you have attained the 888 consciousness, it sends you right through to the original timeline, which is represented as 999. The reversal of 666. When I made a personal decision to dissolve all mechanical conditions of the physical realm, I was seeking the realm of 999, although I had no idea of this particular terminology at that time. That I had some fantastic experiences is a result of the simple maxim, seek and ye shall find. The connection is there for all who want to avail themselves of it. Chapter 40, Lyra and Beyond. There is one other aspect of the Pleiades which should be commented upon before we close out this work. In his book, The Masks of God, Creative Mythology, Joseph Campbell brings to light an interesting artifact uncovered from the early Christian era. It is a cylindrical seal which reads Orpheus Bacchicos and has a crucified man with a crescent moon resting atop the cross. Overhead are the 7 stars which Campbell identifies as the Pleiades. He also tells us that the Pleiades were known to antiquity as the Lyre of Orpheus. The inscription Orpheus Bacchicos literally means true man, true God. Orpheus was an earlier prototype of Christ that existed in Greek mythology. He was the son of Egris, the king of Thrace, and the muse Calliope. Apollo favored Orpheus and blessed him with many talents. He also gave him a lyre with 7 strings. It was said that Orpheus played the lyre with such melodious and moving tunes that the rivers stopped flowing, trees ceased to rustle, and the rocks followed him. He could also tame ferocious beasts. His voice was so gentle and beautiful that he could calm the waves or lull dragons to sleep. Orpheus is also said to have taught the mysteries of Eleusis after his own initiation into the mysteries of Osiris. After participating in the search for the Golden Fleece with the Argonauts, Orpheus married a nymph who was bitten by a serpent and died. Overwhelmed with grief, he sought and gained permission from Zeus to bring her back to Earth from the underworld. Using his lyre, he calmed the wild beasts and furies of Hades, but he was warned not to look at his beloved until he reached the land of the living. Just before he reached the gates of the underworld, he looked back to be sure that his wife was following him. She vanished from his sight and never returned. Upon returning to the living, Orpheus remained faithful to his wife and spurned the love of all other women who tore him limb from limb. This myth follows the pattern of Osiris, who was also torn to pieces. It shows that the love of Orpheus transcended worldly love and that the creatures of Earth would ultimately reject him and his principles. The most important part of the myth is his lyre with 7 strings. This illustrates the power of the septenary influence. He could literally control matter and sway the wild beasts. In this respect, the Pleiades are concerned with the realm of consciousness in which the blueprints for creation take place. If we wanted to go and inspect the blueprints for the different aspects of Earth, we are advised to visit the Pleiades. A highly charged form of energy has been found to exist within the Pleiades constellation and is known as the photon belt. As our Sun circles the Pleiades approximately every 24,000 years, we can only wonder what exact effect this photon belt has on our culture or the entities who claim to channel energy from this region. In any event, that location in our galaxy is inundated with light. In practical experience, you might find that the Pleiadians operate something along the lines of holography. This is like the principle by which Nikola Tesla thought out his projects in full detail before he committed them to written blueprints. He was always correct. All of this information, in combination with the mythological aspects related in this book, indicates that Preston Nichols' experience in the Pleiades was not just a dream. Perhaps only time or your own experiences will tell exactly what the truth is. Although the Pleiades have been referred to as a blueprint room, there has been no mention of the architect. Perhaps that is a story for a different time. But we are offered a clue with the lyre of Orpheus. After Orpheus was torn apart and died, Zeus honored the requests of Apollo and the Muses by placing the lyre in the stars in memory of him and his works. Today that constellation is known as Lyra. The archetype of Lyra is discussed in a book entitled The Prism of Lyra. According to this book and different legends, the humanoids that settled the Pleiades, Sirius, and Orion all originated from Lyra. It is thought of as a prism because after the fall from the original timeline, consciousness fragmented from pure light into the 7 rays of light as distinguished in the colors of the rainbow. Lyra is thought of as the matrix from which light originated. This brings us to a new subject which should properly be dealt with as a separate endeavor, the study of light. Note, those who want to further study the archetypal implications of Lyra should read The Prism of Lyra by Lissa Royal and Keith Priest. Epilogue, by Peter Moon. This book began with the personal experiences of Preston Nichols. The purpose of relaying his information is not only to tell an interesting story but to bridge a gap in humanity's understanding of UFOs and their accompanying phenomena. The purpose of my personal story is to demonstrate the existence of unseen forces of consciousness working to enlighten mankind and how they enabled the telling of Preston's story to take place. All of the books I have written with Preston Nichols are criticized by some for being disjointed, and this one will be no exception. Although I make every effort possible to communicate clearly, there is a reason why the pieces of the puzzle are never in perfect focus. We are writing about phenomena that transcends the third dimension. The phenomena is not part of this realm and the information does not come as easy as finding the maintenance manual for a motorcycle. Obviously, critics and everyone else, including myself, would like everything handed to them on a silver platter as far as transcending the third dimension. My interest in saying all this is not to silence critics but to bring home a very important point. Spiritual evolution is hard work. It is not arrived at merely by reading books. Although books can be a boost, one has to put ideas into practice in order to change conditions. Each person's path is a separate and individual journey. For those who are seeking their own path, clues have been included in this book as to how you might go about it. All you really have to do is consult your own intuition and follow the horizon of your own consciousness. If those words don't ring a bell, then it isn't meant to be rung. In keeping with the above, I would like to end this work with the last words the Buddha was said to have spoken. Decay is inherent in all component things. Work out your salvation with diligence. Appendix A, Antique Sources, by Preston B. Nichols. The UFO I have described in the main section of this book is a very advanced form of flying saucer. It has the typical operating system found inside the spherical ships and some of the flying discs. It is a complete state of their art virtual reality system. There are also other types of flying craft around that I will now discuss. Although I have labeled them antique saucers, they are far ahead of mankind's popular technology. The next level of technology down from the state of their art UFO is their wedge-shaped ship. This is similar to the more advanced craft in that it has input chairs for the occupants. There are anywhere from 2 to 6 input chairs depending upon the complexity of the craft. A major difference with this craft is that you can see a control panel of sorts. There are some knobs and buttons as well as video screens. I get the impression that one of the controls might be a startup button. The actual steering and navigation functions are still imputed by neurological means from the beings. Rather than a crystal computer, the wedge ship has a more conventional style computer that uses a very advanced chip technology. This connects to equipment constructed in part from earth materials such as silver, gold, platinum, iron, copper, and aluminium. You will also find alloys in the equipment that are literally impossible to find on earth. The wedge-shaped ship has more normal-looking technology than the advanced craft. It does, however, operate on the same principles of electrogravitation and reality manipulation in order to propel itself. The power is generated from some sort of radioactive pellet in the center of a crystal. The pellet has been identified as element 115. I have heard multiple reports that the wedge ships have fusion or fission reactors. It depends on who you talk to. I have never seen one because it has to be taken apart to understand the exact nature of the reactor. I believe there are separate weapons and communications systems in the wedge ship. The more advanced ships have these built into the other interfacing functions aboard the craft, all controlled through the operator. The cigar-shaped ships are likewise powered by element 115 and use technology similar to ours, except that they are somewhere between 50 to 100 years ahead of us. They have one chair and a massive control panel for this ship. The systems are bigger and more diversified, with most of the input coming from the control panel as opposed to beings in a chair. The cigar craft also uses an anti-gravity system and a generator. The interesting point is that all the different sources use the same frequency transform to generate their twisters and spinners. See Chapter 6 for an explanation of these terms. In doing an electromagnetic signature analysis, I have not heard anything but one electromagnetic signature emanating from UFOs. Apparently, this one signature of 435 MHz is universally used for the drives. If you know what to listen for in the radio bands, you can hear the signature and tell when a UFO is close by. Appendix B, The Particle Accelerator, by Preston B. Nichols. Note: the information in this appendix originally appeared in the book Pyramids of Montauk. In the fall of 1993, a particle accelerator had been discovered as a result of me doing a video fly by of Camp Hero. What appeared to be a large circle cut out of the foliage was identified as a particle accelerator by my friend Danny, a nuclear physicist. I was showing him overhead videos I'd taken of the base. He got excited and asked me to freeze the frame. He then pulled out a diagram of a particle accelerator, held it up to the screen and began to identify the various parts of a particle accelerator. Here is the beam line. Here is the maintenance port. Here is the cryogenics, the science that deals with the production of very low temperatures and their effect on the properties of matter, port. Down here is the particle injection point. If one were to overlay Danny's particle accelerator diagram on my video screen, it would fit exactly where the Montauk circle appeared. All of this sheds a new light on the Montauk project. I began to research accordingly and studied particle accelerators. What I found was that a very large particle accelerator is used to feed smaller ones. I believe the larger one to be located at Brookhaven National Labs. Because of the energetic interactions that occur between the different accelerators, the smaller ones have to be located some distance from the main one. Montauk and the eastern end of Long Island were chosen as an ideal location for the smaller accelerators. Next, I will explain how this system of particle accelerators works. If you are not technically minded, you might wish to skip the rest of this appendix. The process begins with the injection of protons into the large accelerator. A proton is a positively charged particle within the nucleus of an atom. It is the antithesis of an electron. For the purposes of the accelerator, the protons were generated by stripping the electrons off of hydrogen atoms. First, they separated the light hydrogen from the heavy hydrogen. This gave them light hydrogen with no neutrons in the nucleus. It is then very easy to strip the electron off of the hydrogen atom and given it a positive charge. It would then be a proton. A proton stream was then injected into the large accelerator and the protons would begin to accelerate. The protons generated would expand and begin to take up more space until they became more and more virtual. At the output point of the large accelerator, the protons were traveling at about 5c. C equals the speed of light, so 5c is half the speed of light. From the output point, the protons were sent down a magnetically focused tunnel and injected into the accelerator ring on the Montauk base itself. It would then be further accelerated to the speed of light. What you are doing at the speed of light is taking advantage of the Albert Einstein formula that says energy is equal to mass times the velocity of light squared, E equals mc2, where 2 is the square of. The reason this is significant is that a particle at the speed of light is going to have a certain amount of energy based upon the mass-velocity relationship in Einstein's equation, the other form of which can be stated E equals mv2, where v stands for velocity. The maximum velocity is the speed of light, so the maximum energy is where v is replaced by c. The whole idea of a particle accelerator is that you are getting a unit of electromagnetic energy, a proton, which acts like a particle, to continually increase its velocity. As the particles are converted to the speed of light, vast amounts of energy are released because you are going from the real world to a totally imaginary world, which could also be defined as mental energy. As I continued to study the particle accelerator at Montauk with Dan, all sorts of alarm bells and light bulbs were set off in my head because it enabled me to explain a problem I'd been encountering for years. Whenever I asked different psychics to read how much power they had at Montauk, they would invariably come up with an astronomical amount, a million megawatts of energy. This didn't make any sense because if you're going to run an amplifier of 1 million megawatts, it will require at least 2 million megawatts of power. There isn't enough power on Long Island to run the thing. When I communicated this to Dan, he had already explained to me what I have just relayed about the different particle accelerators attaining the speed of light. I then asked him how much energy one of these particle accelerators could produce upon attaining the speed of light. Dan then grabbed a chart which had a number of things on it, including energy output in comparison to circular diameters of accelerators. We had already measured the Montauk circle as having a 625-foot diameter. Sure enough, on Dan's chart we found one of the entries to be 625 feet. Was that a mere coincidence? We estimated the other items from the chart, including the diameter of the beam and the energy being put into it. Dan did some figuring and said that the particle accelerator at Montauk was equivalent to a 100-megaton nuclear device. He then went to another chart to find out what 100 megatons converts to in terms of power. It equaled 1 million megawatts of power, the same amount different psychics had read. I began to discover more about particle accelerators after my meeting with Dan. I came across a number of reports of very large power amplifiers being built for particle accelerators. They were designed to operate at 435 MHz, which means they probably found their way out to Montauk. These power amplifiers were called klystrons and replaced the huge amplitrons used in the underground. This was obviously an engineering decision because two or three klystrons could do the work of 24 amplitrons. They are easier to power and act similarly to a magnetron except that they are linear with no orbit. A magnetron is a microwave signal source similar to that in a microwave oven. It consists of a tube with an electron orbit that produces vast amounts of RF energy. Klystrons consist of a tube of about 100 feet long and 20 feet in diameter and are essentially a high-powered microwave amplifier that drives the particle beam accelerator. In the particle beam amplifier, which is the same as saying particle beam accelerator, they use atomic particles like neutrons and protons instead of electrons, which are used in a magnetron or amplitron. The protons, neutrons are then focused into an orbit so that a resonant action occurs in the cavities of the accelerator. A cavity is a resonant space which is bounded by a reflective surface of RF energy such as a metal plate or shielded surface. It is physically resonant based upon the velocity, in this case the speed of light. These neutrons, protons were specially grouped in their orbit so as to act like energy packets in a magnetron or amplitron, which both have orbiting electrons. As the particles in the particle accelerator were sent around the circle at Montauk, thus approaching the speed of light, the cavity would group with the atomic particles into energy packets. The cavity is then resonating with the energy from the particles. When the electron beam is accelerated further, it imparts energy into the cavities and that translates into output. The particle accelerator already has a particle orbit. The trick is to somehow group the particles in terms of relativistic phase velocity. If this is done, as the particle beam is approaching the speed of light, you could then literally tap the energy out of the particle accelerator with a group of cavities just like in a magnetron. Within the particle beam amplifier that includes the 625-foot diameter circle at Montauk, two sets of cavities are positioned at right angles to each other surrounding a circle. Using the output of about a 30-megawatt transmitter, you drive one group of cavities on one of the axes which we'll call the x-axis. Just as in a regular amplitron, the input power groups the electron beam spinning around in the amplitron with one set of cavities. This is called slow wave structure. Slow wave refers to particles traveling below the speed of light. In the particle beam amplifier, we're not dealing with slow wave but with light velocity wave structure. The input cavities then group the particle beam at about 9c. As the particle is accelerated faster and reaches c, it is going to release all the energy. The energy will then be released upon the bunched particles and the y cavity will then pick up the energy. It is positioned 90 degrees away from the x cavity and conducts the energy in whatever manner has been set. In order to output the energy from the particle amplifier, it would be normal to put it into waveguides and send it back to the radar tower. But, this won't work because with 1 million megawatts the waveguides would melt. Instead of taking the energy out of the particle beam amplifier as an energy beam, they allowed the particle beam amplifier to become the antenna. The E-field antenna which coupled in with the delta T antenna was actually the circle of the particle beam amplifier which has an output power of 1 million megawatts. This is definitely enough to bend space and time. They constructed the output cavity to go to some sort of rectifier which I still don't fully understand at this point. Some of this energy was used to drive the delta T antenna, the top tip of which is just below the center of the ground. The bottom tip is way below the center of the ground and under the particle accelerator. To power the X and Y coils of the delta T, They tapped the particle accelerator just above the ground. They then drove a Z-coil, possibly as a white noise source, from the particle accelerator in the main town of Montauk, the traffic circle in the center of town. It is my supposition that they may have gotten some of that energy accelerated to the speed of light. Since the output from the accelerator in town was not modulated, it would be white noise and would serve as the correlating signal for bending time, reference chapter 12 of the Montauk Project. Bending time is not the only use of the particle accelerator. It is also used today as a particle beam weapon. It is known that UFOs are sensitive to 435 MHz with a 20 MHz bandwidth. This is accomplished by using one set of cavities to bunch the particle beam at 435 mH. Then they will use the particle beam port with reflective mirrors and magnetic focusing to launch this thing as a particle beam weapon. When they do this, they generate two interlacing helical beams, very similar to the caduceus function. By controlling the phasing beams, they can control how far out they'll travel, and at some point a destructive interference will occur. The beams will destroy each and in turn create an interference which will generate a miniature black hole. Modulation is the key to getting through the shield of the UFO, which has been well known since the days of the early Sage radar when they began shooting down UFOs.